Welcome to the Possibility Project, an open conversation series where changemakers talk about the big questions we need to answer now. Your hosts are Devin Davey and Heather Hiscox, together with technical help from the nonprofit Snapcast. This series empowers the listener to shift systems, rebuild structures, and foster equity in the social impact sector.
And for each of our topics, we list a set of resources that each of the speakers have shared with us. So please check those out. And LaToya put in the website there. Thanks so much. Okay, next slide, Devin. So I just want to introduce ourselves and what Possibility Project is all about. So we're going to be using the Zoom introduction guidelines that a previous episode guest, Nova Wren from Genesis Healing Institute, that he uses. And so we've used a portion of those. We want to share those with you. So LaToya is going to put those in the chat. He has offered those to any of you that have meetings and you want to have different ways to introduce your groups to come together. So my name is Heather Hiscox. I use she, her pronouns. I'm coming to you from the land that was kept and held sacred by the Tohono O'odham and Pasquayaki people. I honor these ancestral keepers of this land where I am now living, and I honor their descendants who continue to breathe sacred life into our earth. So territory acknowledgements, we know, are just one tiny, tiny way that are a part of dismantling, disrupting colonial structures. And if you want to learn more about how this lightly touches the surface of privilege and power, we're going to put a couple links in the chat where you can learn more and you can find out what land you occupy. So there's a couple phone numbers that we're going to put in the chat and a couple websites you can go to. And for any of you that are visually impaired, I am a redheaded, freckled, light-skinned woman, and I'm in a light blue room wearing a blue top. And today we're going to have all of the thoughts that are shared. They're going to be transcribed and we'll send that recording with the video and the full audio transcription that we post after every episode. So if you want to have a deeper engagement with that content, it will be available to you. So after each event, it takes us about 48 hours. We'll send you an email with all of the resources and all of the recordings to check out. So my amazing co-creator is Devin Davey, and Devin's a strategy consultant helping female social entrepreneurs co-design and implement people and process solutions. You can learn more about her work on her website, devindavey.com. We'll have that in the chat. And I'm Heather Hiscox, CEO and founder of Pause for Change, and I help nonprofits, local governments, and philanthropic foundations address challenges and solve problems more efficiently and effectively. So my website will be there as well. And Devin and I created this project when COVID hit because we started having amazing conversations with folks in our network. And we wanted to bring those conversations that we joke used to be only in dark corners when you had to kind of look around the restaurant. We want to bring those to scale into a larger group of people. So that's really what this work is all about, is creating this community of disruptors to come together to talk about the topics we must discuss. So these are our four goals. We're uniting a community of diverse change makers. We're stimulating new thinking and a thirst for deeper change. We're exploring what's possible together, and we're examining our role as individuals. We're starting with ourselves of how we can create change. And this work has been entirely volunteer fueled with our speakers and ourselves. And so if you would like to support any of this work, you can check out our page at opencollective.com/possibilityproject. We'd appreciate any support you can provide. Okay, Devin, next slide for me. So here's the flow for our time together. We have a full 90 minutes. So we're going to provide intros of our guests. You'll get to meet another person, another one of your peers that's here today. Our guests will give lightning talks focused on dysfunction. Then we're going to have a more fluid chat about what's emerging and gives us hope and what action we can take. And then we're going to have time for Q&A. So fill that chat with all the questions and things you're thinking about. We'll refer to those as we go along. And Devin will have those ready for our guest. And then we're going to go deep at about the hour mark. Some of you have to hop off, which we'll miss you dearly. But if you can stick around after that point, we do breakout groups where you get to go with a small group of other people that are still on the call and talk about what our guests have discussed, what's sticking for you, meeting more people, deepening that connection with others. And then our guests will share some takeaways, and then we'll talk about our next episode, which will happen in April. Okay, next step. All right, so we really wanted to focus on this topic, and it was so interesting because in our last episode with Chris Rudd and Katie Krumick, it came up about empathy. Like, what is the role of empathy? Is it really, are we really empathetic? Are we just doing a couple of interviews and patting ourselves on the back and saying, done, check the box. We talked to some people. Are we really, what Chris was talking about, are we really showing deep care and concern for the stakeholders that we're here to work with? And so that whole idea of, not creating for, but creating with. And so we wanted to continue and extend that conversation. And we have some of the absolute best experts in this area to go deeper in empathy. So we're so excited. So can you stop sharing the screen for me, Devin? Awesome. Okay. So I'm going to introduce our speakers, and we do things a little bit different here at Possibility Project. We don't do the normal, like, giant bio that we read through. So we will post it in the chat, and you got a chance to see it on your registration reminder email. But we like to introduce our speakers very briefly, and then we have them share an interesting or fun story. Something about them that makes them human, makes us all smile, we feel connected, and then we jump into these meaty topics. So first, I'm going to introduce Mylene Garcia. Mylene is the head of digital strategy and engagement at the City and County of San Francisco. And Mylene has an interesting travel story about traveling while hungry. So Mylene, take it away.
Well, my quick 2-minute story is that my childhood close best friend of mine, we've been friends since I was 6 years old. We arrived in Iceland. We decided that we were going to drive around the entire ring of Iceland in 6 days. And so, footnote for everyone, it actually takes 9 to 10 days to do this, recommended. And we were about to embark on this trip. But we decide that we, after picking up our rental car, wanted to get something to eat. And we want to try our hand at ordering Icelandic fast food. And we look at the menu and we think we're ordering off the dollar menu. And instead, we order, I think, about 8 cheeseburgers, a 2 liter of Coke, and probably 6 stacks of French fries. It was probably about $75 worth of like Icelandic fast food that just kept coming through the drive-through. And of course, we were also the people stalling the entire line because we didn't know what we were ordering. So that's my one boof, traveling boof, on the lovely island of Iceland.
I love that. Good note for all of us when we take our Icelandic adventure. So I'm next going to introduce Mari. So Mari Nakano is design director of the Service Design Studio in New York City Mayor's Office for Economic Opportunity. And Mari also has a fun travel adventure story to share.
I do. And then I changed my mind because this weekend I was talking to my mom on her birthday, and my brother and I got on Zoom and were, I think we basically roasted her. She shouldn't have done. But she reminded me of this crazy story when I was a bit younger. I don't know for folks who are maybe have grown up, born and raised in San Francisco, but there was a radio guy named Narcy David who used to do the food news. And that day, and we had a radio hooked up in the kitchen, and what my mom and dad would listen to it all the time. And it would just kind of blast all through the house. And so I was one day hearing Narcy David's voice come on, and he's like, "Good morning, everybody," or "Good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm going to show you, or I'm going to explain to you how to get the peach fuzz off a peach." And he's like, "So what you want to do is, get those fresh peaches you've picked this summer and rub that under warm water and just do a circular motion, and all the peach fuzz will come off." And I'm like not in the kitchen during all of this, and I'm hearing my mom and dad giggle, and my mom suddenly goes, "We tried that on Madi's cheeks and that didn't work." And so I walk in, through the beaded curtains, and I was just like, "I heard that, mom." But it just sticks. It's just one of those stories that just sticks with me to this day. So just sharing that.
I love that. I love that. Thank you for sharing. So great. So our last guest here is Amy Wilson. She's the author of the brand new book that just got released, called Empathy for Change: How to Create a More Understanding World. And she's also the CEO of Empathy for Change. And Amy has a very, very interesting certification.
Yes, it's lovely. So, when you're a leader, sometimes you have to take one for the team. And so when I was in Right after college, I left my job in consulting to go join AmeriCorps after Hurricane Katrina and Rita. And I was living in a gutted out elementary school. We were doing training with my team. I was a team leader in AmeriCorps and CCC, the National Civilian Community Corps, and everybody was doing all this training. And so everybody on our team had to do about 10 or 15 hours of chainsaw training. And so like you had to be certified in that. And so everybody else on my team was like, I really don't want to do this. Like everyone on my team was like, not really loving it. So I was like, okay, I'll take one for the team and I'll learn how to do this with everybody else. So just imagine me, like I'm in suit mode right now, like actually business on the top and like, you know, casual on the bottom right now. But just imagine me getting 8 hours of certification training on how to use a chainsaw. And I was wearing chainsaw chaps, bright orange chainsaw chaps, and like this amazing helmet with like, you know, earmuffs on there. And I'm still to this day terrified of actually using a chainsaw. But I'm certified to use one. And one thing I love to say about this, it's great for dating profiles. It goes really well with that. And then the second thing is that I know how to limb and buck a tree. So that sounds oddly sexual in a weird way. So yeah, it's one of my certifications. So I should put that up on my resume next time.
Exactly. So you know who to call, everyone, if you have a tree, a tree question. You can talk about empathy and tree care.
And tree care.
Awesome. Well, see, that's how we do our fun intros. So now you get a chance to have a fun time talking to someone new. We always want to make sure we do a little bit of networking here. So I'm going to send you in pairs to breakout rooms just for a moment. So if you can turn on your video so your partner can say hello, that would be great. And what the prompt is that we want you to discuss, you'll just have a couple minutes, is discuss something that made you smile today. If you feel willing to share that with your partner, tell them something that made you smile today. So I'm going to send you to the room so you'll have a couple minutes. We'll see you back in just a moment.
Welcome back, everyone.
Hi. I hope you had a great conversation with your other lovely person that you got to meet. And if you can stick around past the hour mark, you'll get to meet other lovely people. I don't have Raman's algorithm program, so you might have to meet the same person. Who knows? We'll see what happens. But we now are going to transition to what we call our lightning talks. And these are when our speakers answer our first question. And for some of you that are new, we always ask the same two questions every episode. What dysfunctions do you want to disappear related to the topic? So around empathy and equity-centered work. So they get to talk about like what's messed up, what's the stuff, like the negative, they can go there. And then we then transition after each person has their talking time to having more fluid conversation about what's emerging that gives you hope. What gets you excited? Like what's the cool stuff we can all do to make this change? All right, so Mylene, I'm wondering if you can kick us off and answer that question. What dysfunctions around empathy and equity center work do you want to disappear?
Unmuted. I think the thing for me, particularly since, you know, we had many Asian women victimized last week in Atlanta, that has really resonated with me in the last week is that old news is somehow treated as new news. And I think that treating old news as new news is a dysfunction. And so for me, I'm really hoping that we can find different ways to acknowledge, you know, the history of people when coming to a variety of different situations. So I think that I'll leave that there for the first minute.
Okay. All right. So Mari, I want to ask you now, what would you say, what dysfunctions do you want to disappear?
I'm sure this has been on other episodes before, but there are so many. You know, when you first posed this question, I was like, you could probably make the worst dysfunctions in fill in the blank sector game, you know, and like play all night long on this. But as I was thinking about this question, there's several dysfunctions that really came to mind in regards to what we're talking about today with equity and empathy. I think the first one's really this hustle and grind culture Everyone deals with this, but those who really suffer the most are our lower paid staff, our women, moms, staff of color, and others who diverge from like the work culture norm, which is often rooted in white dominant attitudes here in the States. So, and you know, we treat everything like it's urgent these days, that everything's about what scales faster or how many likes you get in this sort of shortest period of time on social media. And I think a lot of us play into that and really swept into those currents, you know, and I think another big one is, you know, I'm sure a lot of you have heard safe space and brave space, and how can we create these safe, brave spaces, you know, or brave spaces these days in our work, in our offices, you know, but I think at the same time, yes, we do need to create brave spaces, but you know, at the same time, the fact that we have to say that we have to be brave at our jobs, that we have to, you know, get together to like pump each other up to speak up to our leaders and to our organizations, that's dysfunctional, you know, to me. Two other ones that I was thinking of, just, you know, when I see press releases go out from, you know, the city, or, you know, people who are making social impact investments and saying they have invested or donated X thousands or millions of dollars. I think the part that I am always a little bit disgruntled by is that at the end of the day, when we're funding programs and services at essential workers or case planners or things, those types of people who are on the front line have to deliver, we don't pay attention to how little we pay them. And so we really need to examine that as well. I think the last one is to another dysfunction is a sort of false narrative or othering of low income BIPOC or immigrant communities who are treated as monoliths or like charity cases. You know, everybody's been talking, I see in this chat, about like designing for with versus for. And we really need to change that, you know, to really talking more about what designing with is, you know. I think basically, you know, we really have to stop asking, like, how can the systems we design help communities get out of some kind of deficit? Rather, I think these days we need to be really asking instead, like, what did our systems do to these communities? What did they take away from these communities? And what responsibilities do these systems have to really undo that damage and really make sure that communities can focus on recovering and thriving? So that's just, that's one of the other dysfunctions that I've been thinking about.
Thank you for that. Amy.
Thank you. One of the things I was thinking about, I was struck in my research when I was researching my book, Empathy for Change, How to Create a More Understanding World, was this quote by Charles Blow, who is a New York Times op-ed columnist and author of the new book, The Devil You Know, The Black Power Manifesto. And it just came out around the same time my book came out, which was fascinating that this is coming out at the same time. He says, "One doesn't have to operate with great malice to do great harm. The absence of empathy and understanding are sufficient. Just the fact that you aren't there and you're not feeling empathy with somebody." So that's the quote that really rings true. I think every time, you know, a tragedy happens or when we work in the workplace. And so one of the things that I bring to the light in the beginning of the book is I speak about an empathy deficit that we had. And it's interesting that Mari just mentioned it, like, let's not talk about it in deficits. I'm trying to think about how do we talk about it in like a interesting way, a new way that is generative. But what we really need to do is change course from the chaos that our life has been. And the systems we've relied on for decades have really broken down in the pandemic. And we're seeing that a lot of more people are speaking truth to power, and power has been shifting in the world. And I saw this firsthand before I even got to write the book in the first place. I started writing it in the middle of 2019. And I was building a change movement in the government as a presidential innovation fellow. And what we were trying to do is to create a better government movement of people. It was like the power is distributed, you know, it was a catalyst for me to realize that at the end of the day, I you know, was forced and working with the, started in the Obama administration, went to the Trump administration. And I realized that, you know, our values didn't match. And so what happened is after 3 years of that culture change movement that we had built, the Trump administration completely shut it down. And what I realized is we really need a lot more reinforcements for the change we wish to seek. We need a lot more people on the side of being like, oh yeah, this is not working, right? The systems that we're in is not working. So I started thinking deeper. I believe that in my mind that really we talk about a lot of innovation, but what we really need to be talking about is positive change. So what I say is positive change is empathy plus action. And we don't understand empathy. We don't understand like what really is empathy. Happy to go more into it. But at the end of the day, like we need to understand, like we have this idea what we call innovation. It's elusive, but we really need to make sense of what's happening in the world and then act upon it. So what I would say also is that in the book, I talk about the role addiction has played in my life and in my family. And I find it really interesting to bring into the conversation today, because I think we have learned ways of working and that makes our lives unmanageable in many ways. And especially when we talk about the social sector, I've worked in multiple sectors, but for the most past like 5 to 6 years, I've been focusing on the social sector. And I mentioned a group called Adult Children of Alcoholics. It's a 12-step program that is steeped in love, understanding, and change. And so it's about spirituality and how in that community, I've been there for about 5 years. And that's when the word dysfunction came into my lexicon. And what we try to do from that learning is that we have learned a lot of maladaptive behaviors as children and young adults that we've brought into adulthood that no longer really serve us. But we also bring that to our communities and to the world. And so we need to like retrain ourselves, and which we call reparenting ourselves, to find our true selves. And that is all done in community. That's where the empathy comes in, where we're in community with others. So the conclusion I've come to is our systems are broken, but we can redesign it and restructure it. But it all starts with us. Right? And we have to kind of start thinking about what does empathy mean for us? How do we live it every day? And what's the actions we're taking? And so I decided to write the handbook for how to redesign the world around us, and had many conversations with Mai Ling, and Mari is connected in the book as well. And I use principles of openness, transparency, and participation that, you know, that's the way we should be creating the world in the future. So I just wanted to mention like two more things, and then I'll open it up for people. I know probably we're the 3 minute mark, but I just have so much to say about this topic. And when I talk about dysfunction, I talk dysfunction in our workplaces, in the social sector, in different, all different places. And dysfunction happens when there's a mismatch between the stated values and what happens on the ground. And I believe that we're so used to being in dysfunction that we've accepted the things that things won't change. And as a result, we're re-traumatizing ourselves in our workplaces and the structures around us. So dysfunction like this happens for a number of reasons. And it's, you know, there's things that I've seen in my research. Employees have made a change in the past and they were punished for it. Like their hands are slapped. And the next time they don't want to deal with the fallout, they also are afraid of losing their job. And also they want to feel safe, like either physically, emotionally, or mentally safe. So those in power, though, are creating a culture of fear and intimidation, perfectionism, urgency, either or thinking, individualism, and a belief that those in power have a right to psychological and physical comfort. So, and then they scapegoat those who are in discomfort. So this is actually something that is from the characteristics of white supremacy culture, came out 20 years ago. And it just was like, what? This is like going back to what you were saying, Mai Ling, is like old, you know, this is stuff that we've known for a while, but we're not making a lot of the changes. So I really think that this is the dysfunction we need to overcome in our lifetime. How do we tackle this? I personally believe that increasing empathy and awareness will help us lead us to the change that we wish to seek. I was saying the other day that it's almost like empathy is like a Trojan horse for us to go into communities and organizations and start talking about this culture that we need to break down. So that's my TED Talk. Not actually 18 minutes, but probably more like five. But there, that's what I got to say.
Thank you. And I'm going to go back to Mai-Ling. Mai-Ling, add more, say more.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that building on some of the points that Amy and Mari brought up about this, you know, idea of values distortion, I think that a really significant dysfunction that we have is a chronic failure, both socially, but also in these like micro settings of our homes and our workplaces, of acknowledging and attributing value, right? And sometimes that is a really, you know, small kind of verbal acknowledgement, whether that's a nod, whether that's naming somebody in a conversation, whether that's actually giving somebody accolades for something that they're contributing to. But sometimes it's just paying people, right? Like I think Mari alluded to this earlier, which is, you know, what we sort of deem as essential and what's sort of extremely functional right now has become so critically important during this pandemic. And we're really starting to, I think, unpack what that real value is to all of us socially. A really great quote that I actually read on Twitter this morning was Senator Warnock in Georgia, in response to a lot of these shootings, said that the shooter was able to kill 8 people the same day that he purchased a gun. But right now, the Georgia legislature is trying to prevent people from voting the same day that they register. So again, it's really, you know, A, that we have a significant values distortion that's happening socially, locally, nationally, at every level of our society. And the other thing that's also happening is that we can see that leadership is setting the tone and that we are still paying for the failure and the vacuum of leadership we had in the previous administration that we now need to sort of scramble to fill. And without, you know, in this kind of void, because I think that there is a vacuum here, I think that it's really up to us to really define and determine the value of both, you know, what we're actually producing, what our economic value is, but also our very lives.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm thinking of bringing up the legislation that's going on, and we're seeing it in a lot of states, right? A lot of this very interesting backlash in policy. I want to now pivot to talking about what's giving us hope. So answering that question of what's giving you hope, what's emerging that fuels you, that thinks that we're heading towards a brighter, more empathetic future. So I'm wondering, Mari, do you wanna take us away and talk about some of the things that you're seeing that give you hope?
Yeah, you know, this question was probably harder for me to think about than the dysfunction piece, because we are just operating in such a dysfunctional environment and climate these days. And so to the point where folks like Asian Americans, right, who are completely distracted and hurt right now from the hate crimes that have been happening, not just the ones from last week, but that have been happening, as Mai-Ling was saying, like before all of this, you know, it's been really hard for me to think about healing, to think about positive things right now, because I'm so inundated, you know, and distracted by the pain and the harm that everything, the pandemic and everything, racism is causing these days. But I'll also say that, you know, trying to push through that, being able to push through that gives me hope, that I hear more folks in New York City government talking about how can we genuinely start to center our communities? How can we start to not just treat folks that we're researching and interviewing for the products and the services and the programs that we're supposed to design for them? How are we supposed to actually center them in the work that we're doing in a genuine way? I see today even that gives me some hope is that de Blasio announced, you know, the first racial justice commission here in New York City. And I'm crossing my fingers that that's not just a gestural thing of a group of people coming together to talk about what sucks, you know, and actually going to do actionable systems change here in the city. So that does give me hope. But I'm crossing my fingers too and holding on that we're not just here just doing symbolic acts right now and saying things we know because we're smart enough to like pull from, you know, all the stuff that we're reading on the internet about how to say things right, you know, about how things should be better. I really, really need to see commitment from organizations, from leaders to make that change and to push back and to, you know, recognize, you know, that folks are being gatekeepers to enabling communities to, you know, be better serviced and treated with dignity. So, you know, that's a hodgepodge of things, but I'll pause there.
No, I love it. I love it. It's great to kind of popcorn around lots of different thinking because it touches what so many of us think about all the time and what we're feeling. Myling, what would you say? What's emerging that gives you hope knowing that we are operating in a context that's really difficult right now?
You know, I think for me, I often tell really close family and friends that I really believe that social justice begins at home and begins at work. And I think it's sometimes easy to think that, you know, social media posts or, you know, protests are oftentimes performative, which it's not to say that they aren't. But I think what gives me hope is the level of visibility that is actually mobilizing change and people to organizing different programs and policies, but more importantly, really rethinking how they're operating within, you know, the organizations and systems that they encounter every day, right? So, you know, it's not necessarily starting a new thing or taking a picture next to a poster or, you know, whatever it is, or putting something out on your lawn. You know, is it that, are we A, including people in the meetings that we're having every day? Are we, you know, attributing value to the folks that are in our circles for the work that they're providing? And so I think that those things are really, really important. You know, I had mentioned that I think that a dysfunction is, you know, that the sort of old news is perceived as new news. But I also think, you know, I think about a lot of the work at the Creative Reaction Lab. I think a lot of the work that Antoinette Carroll has really pioneered around equity-centered design. And a lot of that foundationally looks at people's histories and bringing folks' histories into the table before we sort of dissect and work with them. And I think that what I'm observing is a lot of that conversation bubbling up in contexts that we wouldn't normally see them in, or at least for me, what I'm seeing. So, you know, in government, in the workplace, at my kitchen table with my mom, you know, so I think that these places where there may have been longer vacuums of silence, even if those conversations are difficult, even if I don't necessarily agree, I think that the fact that we are having these in the smallest of conversations, even if they're not happening on sort of like big end news, become really, really important and relevant. And that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Thank you. Amy, what would you say? What are some action steps different than, you know, what you've talked about? What's giving you hope and what you're seeing around empathy and equity center work?
Yeah, I agree with Creative Reaction Lab, like plus one to a million times to them and the work that they're doing. Antoinette talks about designing cathedrals, you know, and the work that she's doing is not work that she is going, might not be realized in her lifetime, but we need to be able to do this work to know that like that North Star is there. And Mari, actually, this is something we talked about when I was interviewing you, is the idea of like, we have this North Star and we have to have that purpose and lock into that purpose so that we can see that at the end of the day, this is what we're doing and this is what we're working for. And at the end of the day, if you're locked into that purpose of what the work is, especially in the social sector, and then you're also focused on, you know, a lot of people could say customer experience, but I really think you have to think about the people at the end of the day what do they need and want, and what are the desires? And so that tapping into that purpose and understanding in a bigger way, and not just focusing on kind of like a monolith. People are not monoliths. We need to kind of like understand in the bigger way when we go into this, these worlds of design, that there's a ripple effect, that if we center ourselves and be, and one of the things that Creative Reaction Lab talks about is humility, is that we center ourselves in the humility aspect of it. So, but what I've also seen, which kind of gives me bigger hope, is that more in right now in the pandemic, more than any other time in recent history, things are really coming in a sharper focus for many people, and it's, and people are calling out dysfunction. And what's interesting is I have a whole chapter based on the pandemic and how the a pandemic and crises increases altruism like thousands of times percent, because you start seeing that you are more like each other. Right. And you were all in this together. And you can see that when the pandemic was starting, people, you know, if you remember in Italy, people were singing with each other in this courtyard because they're in it together. And also it shines a light on broken systems. So people, more people than I've ever seen, are speaking up and calling people out on their shit and the behaviors that they're having. One person I wanted to point out is Vivian Castillo. She recently left Salesforce, citing rampant microaggressions and gaslighting. She was the manager of design research and innovation at Salesforce. She's also the founder of Humanity Centered Curriculum and Network for Design Professionals. But what I find is really fascinating is this image that comes into the mind that she brings into her letter that she published online. And she says, she likens her experience to that of a canary in a coal mine. In their early 1900s, miners would send canaries into the coal mine to detect carbon monoxide and other deadly gases. So if the canaries became ill or died, it signaled the miners what the spaces that the miners were going into were not safe and they were toxic. Right, when we talk about like dysfunction and toxicity. So she leveraged this as, to talk about this toxic workplace, but explain the cost of unpaid, unsupported labor that minorities often take in addition to their higher jobs in their corporations and the places that they're in. And so she, this is a quote from her letter that says, "I'm grown tired of watching the canaries of underrepresented minorities go into the coal mines of Salesforce's culture. I've grown tired of watching the canaries of underrepresented minorities experience unchecked harm, only to then turn to the Warm Line, which is the advocacy program for BIPOC employees at Salesforce, to support them through their trauma, rather than Salesforce implementing the accountability required to prevent harm. I've grown tired of watching the canaries of underrepresented minorities leave Salesforce, only to watch Salesforce ramp up their efforts to throw more canaries into the culture that caused the previous ones to leave, or worse, suffer in silence." And so that's really powerful. And I think the more people that see that and are outward about it and saying, standing up and saying, I won't stand for this culture, I think that's going to have a ripple effect that we've been alluding to and talking about right now. And the more people that do it, the more we get to kind of take the power back and have more power within ourselves.
So. Agreed. That's, yeah. And Chuck is saying in the link, if you have that letter, there's a couple different questions in the chat, so keep them coming. These are great. Let's see. So Devin's going to ask you for some. I have an interesting and important one I want to direct towards Mari while you add more questions, and we'll have time to go through those. Mari, when we were talking, you were bringing up this dynamic around leaders, that leaders often are so far away from the actual community, right? As you get higher and higher, you get more and more disconnect, but then you as a leader asked to speak for and about the community. Can you talk about some of those areas of improvement that you've seen and some of those disconnects?
Yeah, I mean, with regards to disconnects, and you know, the higher in leadership you tend to get, the furthest away from the communities that you're serving sometimes, right? I mean, it's not always the case, but I see that a lot here, you know, in my work of, let's send out the junior mid-level designers to go do the research, you know, in the field and talk to folks, you know, and like, or, you know, and And I'm just like, why aren't we all, you know, and I'm questioning really, like, if the further, the more time you spend away from the community, the more distant and dislocated you become, and the less helpful you are, you know. And I think it's really important that we really investigate that and like look at that deeply. I try, you know, even though I'm a design director, I really try to insist when we are doing design research that I'm included in that as even just a note taker. I don't need to be the one that's asking the questions and designing the questions, but I want to be there. I want to know who we're working with. And I want to know those stories. And it goes back to this empathy piece, you know. I need to hear those voices too. You know, I need to know what living environments people are in, you know, and when I can do that, I can bring that empathy back to the office. And then it helps me, you know, I was talking about criticizing the brave thing, but it helps me advocate better. It helps me amplify what needs to change and where we need to focus. And I think, and that's me talking in a room of a bunch of senior leaders and directors and commissioners and what have you. And I think we really need to think about that piece, you know. But in addition to that, I think it's really important to, I saw some questions about just like, how do you prevent some of this sort of corruption, you know? And I think we have to really say to ourselves too, you know, from a design perspective, which is very like Eurocentric in a lot of ways, question who is in the room and who's on your team, right? Like, are the people on your team, the people that know these, that understand these stories and not just sympathize with these stories, but are there people on your team who have lived experience, you know, engaging in these systems, who can tell you firsthand, you know, what they went through? I think those types of experiences, and they're an expertise that's really important, just as important as like, you know, a college degree or whatever we have here. So I think we really need to question that and diversify who's not just the people we research in the room, but who's the one on our side that's in the room too, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Devin, we came up with a couple. Oh, Myling has something to add to that. Myling, why don't you jump in and then we'll have Devin ask another question.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think what Mari brought up to me is really, really critical about pushing back on this idea of like expertise and titles, mm-hmm. And what it means to be a designer, particularly if you're sort of at the helm of leadership. You know, again, kind of referring to Antoinette's work and the work at Creative Reaction Lab, you know, I think that body of work really starts to, and for me, was one of the pivotal points that I think in reading and immersing myself in a lot of that knowledge base was really where I started to unpack, well, what does it mean to be a designer? And I think, Amy, I'm not done reading the book quite yet, but I know in the book, like you make a statement about what qualifies you to like write this book. And I think oftentimes people that have to rely a lot on their lived experience or other things that we wouldn't necessarily identify as kind of the appropriate context for design or design thinking, then fall outside of the scope of design. And I think that we really need to push, you know, on that quite a bit.
Yeah, one thing I'll add just on top of that, Myling, is like, I actually, when I was working with Antoinette on this, her case study in the book, the edits she gave me, instead of saying lived experience, she says living experience, which I think is a really great edit, because, you know, what's interesting, and time again, Antoinette's not the only person. Mari talks about it. My friend Victor Uduwewa talks about it too. And he mentions how it's so critical. There's a lot of stuff you don't know, right? You don't know what you don't know. And then if you bring people in from the community, it makes things much richer, and you're actually helping to solve the problems that are having. And one thing I also would say that what she opened my eyes to was this idea that there's no one silver bullet solution to these problems. It's their approaches. So she calls them approaches rather than solutions. And we need to move away from that dialogue, that dichotomy, that either or. It's like there's a problem and a solution, because there's no one solution to these problems. And that's in systems design, that's like completely there, right? Like there's so many approaches to fixing this problem we've got here.
Because even when we talk about, you know, building with versus building for, we're always talking about the designer that possesses those solutions, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that to me, I think speaks to that challenge and that friction that's happening where people with living experience, with experience that is ongoing, are sort of, you know, cast and not valued, going back to the sort of values distortion that we were talking about earlier in the conversation.
Yep, absolutely. And it has to wrap around, I have chapters on power in the book where we talk, and this is really informed by a lot of the work that I've been and talking, people have been talking about, like that I've talked to for the book, but I have this slide up that I shared with the speakers here. But I've been trying to think about, like, we have this idea of designing for, it creates this weird power dynamic, right? So it's like somebody with power and is also of privilege designing for somebody else. It doesn't make people feel very good. It's very extractive, taking from somebody. And then there's, and I'm looking at the slide on my other thing here, so I might be looking over here, but that you're having power over somebody else. And that never makes that person on the bottom feel good, right? And so you're taking the agency away from that person, right? And Myling, we've been talking about this a lot too, but how do you, if you're shifting to designing with somebody, then you are sharing power with each other. You're having equal amounts of power and that agency is equal. So that person now feels like, oh, I might be able to change the world that I'm in. But how do we get to a place where we're designing by, right? These people, the folks with living experts, like that's where I want to get to, but that's not, a lot of people can't think about that, can't fathom that, right? How do we get that place? And the power is given to people. And then that's where the equity comes in a lot more, because equity is equal outcomes. That's what Antoinette says too. She says, equity is equal outcomes. Equality is equal, equal access. So
I was going to say, before I came to San Francisco, I worked in Oakland for several years. You know, Amy and I worked on people-powered policy. That was an Aspen, I think, project. really looking and unpacking how we could sort of make that direct connection. And for me, I believe, and Mari, I think you alluded to this earlier in the conversation too, about, you know, it's really about who we hire and who we have in the room. And we had an Oakland design league, you know, and the idea was really to think through people with that like living experience, not just this sort of like very archetypal, like product expertise, and really attributing them, you know, a sort of equivalent value, both in terms of their status on the team, but also paying them, you know, those kinds of things. That I think were really important to me in thinking through like, well, how do you kind of like orchestrate or build a team that can tackle a significant problem? So I don't know how other folks have kind of approaches.
I also wanted to acknowledge too, Myling, that Hillary Sedovic is on the line. She's from Creative Reaction Labs. So nice to see you, Hillary.
Hey, Hillary.
Oh, you all are so amazing. Mari, I know you probably have something. Y'all could keep going on this. I want to uplift questions from our chat and from our folks who are on the call with us. And I just want to call out a couple. And if one or two of you have thoughts on any one of the questions, just jump in. We'll spend maybe two to four minutes on this. So a question around how do we change how we operate and run our programs to have the space and time for reflection and inclusion and really diverge away from this urgency and perfectionism culture around innovation that was mentioned. A second question being, what are successful strategies you've seen for shifting the ethos from designing for to designing with? A third question, how do we ensure community engagement doesn't lead to exploitation? And how do we center in practicality the community and what we're designing? And I'll share a fourth question. Looking at, in our previous episode, Heather and folks had mentioned that Christopher Rudd made a point about empathy being misplaced to some degree and how a community of care is really important. So how do we empathize with someone we share nothing or not a lot in common with? And how could somebody speak to what you do to empathize practically? So any of those questions, feel free to speak to.
You know, there's so much we could go forever on this, you know, but I'm just going to drop in this blackspace.org's manifesto here Because for those who haven't seen it, this is really grand. This is one of those types of like principles of working and being that I think is simple and easy to understand and think about. But, you know, one of the ways that we've been trying to do this designing with thing is really one of moving at the speed of trust, which is something that's in that Black Space manifesto. We're developing a fellowship program here with New York City Housing Authority residents, you know, low-income folks, mostly Black. Actually, 100% of our fellows are Black, identify as Black, and like it took us over a year to just launch it. Why? Because we didn't want to like push the program development and design along at the pace this quick, crazy pace that we're also used to or being told, you know, compelled to do inside of government. We were like, we need to move at their pace. We need to move at our people's pace. And make time and space for that, even if it means like it's going to take a long time, because if we don't do this, we are going to just continue to, keep brittle the public trust that we so long to build here, you know, and until we start to meet folks where they're at, until we start to relinquish our powers and trust people, then we're not going to make change, because we're always going to be looking down at folks, and we have to change that mentality. I think the other thing, you know, too, is just like, I think one of the few reasons I can do any type of bureaucracy hacking is because I ask a ton of questions. I'm a director, so I can ask those questions, but I demand transparency. How does this budget work? How much time is it going to take someone over at Human Resources Administration to like approve and process this contract? You know, I need to know all those things so I can strategize, but I tell my designers what the barriers are in store for them. And I don't give them snippets. I give them everything, because they're all creative, crazy thinkers. And I want them to be part of helping do that bureaucracy hacking. And it doesn't matter what level you are, you know, in that you just need to build a community. And it doesn't matter if you're junior, senior, director, whatever it is, bringing everyone in the mix to like do that planning together has made the work way more valuable, and people way more invested, and also feeling like we are part of a team, that we're doing this together. And despite like all the craziness and the pressures outside of our team, at least we know that we're building a bond, and we have a vision and principles that are grounding us to keep moving this work for the sake of the people, you know. And to top that off, I would say, to me, design thinking and human-centered design and all those things, it comes from the community, right? Community organizing is like design thinking, just reinterpreted. And I think we really need to return back to that and look at what those kind of community organizing practices are, and really start to say, how do we adopt those back into government spaces so that we can add, we can do just work, you know, not just cool, scalable work, you know, but actually socially just work.
Mm-hmm. I would just add that I think structurally government does have these pockets and spaces for quote unquote engagement people and outreach people. But oftentimes when we look at like where they are on the pay scale, they're paid a lot less. They are sort of not, you know, functionally like high enough on the sort of hierarchy to make those kinds of decisions. And the work that they actually do doesn't necessarily funnel directly into action. So I think that to build on a lot of what Mari had said, I think that there are already some opportunities there to create some of those connections and to write some of those things with things that are already in place in the public sector.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, we are going to move to breakout rooms so that you all can have a chance to chat and connect with someone else. We're just going to talk through some really fast community care items so that we know how we do this here. We invite you to share talking space. Nothing that happens in the breakout rooms is recorded at all, so it is a safe space, but we don't, if anything you want to share in the chat, like an aha or takeaway from your breakout room, keep it de-identified, keep that level of confidentiality there. So share talking space. One of you will be the facilitator. It's just going to be pairs. So just share time. I'm not going to even worry about that. And the prompt is just what's sticking with you. what's really standing out to you from this conversation? Like, what do you want to talk, excuse me, to your partner about? And we'll have about 8 minutes or so. So you'll have time to share with your partner. If you do get lost in the shuffle, come back to the main room and I can assign you to someone. So I'm going to send you to breakout rooms, but you're just going to talk about, you know, what's sticking with you, and we'll send you now. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for joining us. Please do join us for the next Live Possibility Project so you can take part in the breakout sessions that follow. All sessions are recorded. Please visit possibilityproject.org and connect with us on LinkedIn so we can invite you to meet more incredible impact influencers and make new connections with people who care about what you care about. This has been Possibility Project, produced in cooperation with the nonprofit Snapcast.